Time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The Delta variant is full-blown, and as the CDC has said, the transmission is between those that are unvaccinated. We do receive federal funds, and so it is a difficult conversation to have, but really, if you think about it based on science and what science says, it really is not difficult.
We need to be able to audit elections within 10 days after the election, not 10 months. Okay? We need to be able to audit elections before they are certified.
Have you not followed what's happening in our election here?
Absolutely. I covered the audit.
Do you think that it was the right thing to do to delete a bunch of million files the day before the audit?
That was roundly debunked.
No.
Not by the press, but by the Maricopa County Recorder's Office.
Well, you're buying into everything they say. These are the same people who did not want this forensic audit.
If confirmed to lead this agency, I will work with this committee and with Congress to protect intellectual property, U.S. agriculture, and the many products that Americans rely on.
And with us to talk about more COVID-related state and federal and state and city fights, the latest on backlash against Senator Kyrsten Sinema and more, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, good morning.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie making his maiden voyage with us. Tony, welcome. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Emily, let's start off with this state versus city fight now with the governor, and we just heard from Regina Romero, mayor of Tucson. This is not necessarily new, state versus city, but what do you make of this in terms of Tucson wanted to have the ability to fire employees who are not vaccinated, and the governor and his attorney saying, wait just 1 minute.
You know, I think it's interesting to see Ducey versus Romero on this. You know, I think it's a good political fight for Ducey to take on. His lawyers have probably assessed that this is the example where he has the best legal standing, because you don't see him going after Banner or Valleywise or Honor Health or any of those groups. And, you know, I think taking on a Democratic mayor in Tucson is a political win, whether he wins or loses on this. You know, I do think Romero would probably have more to fight back with if she had mirrored the feds and had a testing opt-out option or granted some of those religious exemptions.
Tony, no surprise that the governor is fighting with Democratic mayors in the state. But what do you make about this specific argument?
Well, I think it's no surprise that he's not fighting with his donors at Banner either. So I think that's probably why he's going after the city a little bit. You know, Mayor Romero has taken actions over the course of the year to protect the people of her city and the overwhelming majority of workers who've been vaccinated. And Ducey declared the pandemic over in May of 2020. And so I think the contrast here is just who is taking actions to try and keep the people of Arizona safe. And I'm sure the politics will work itself out, but I do think that Mayor Romero's on the right side of this.
Emily, we also have a state senator, Vince Leach, who is asking the state attorney general to look into this under the so-called 1487 complaint that allows a state legislator to request the AG look into whether or not a city is violating state law. Is that is this more of a policy thing? Do you see this as more of a political thing as well?
No, you know, I think Senator Leach is sincere in pursuing that. He was a big proponent of that 1487 bill that passed. And, you know, he hails from that area. And I think that this is exactly why they fought so hard at the legislature to pass that, is when cities don't step in line and follow executive orders or state statute, they want to be able to go after them and pull funding.
So, Tony, if you were the city council in Tucson and Mayor Romero, would you be more concerned about that, about the AG's investigation, about what the governor's lawyer is saying? Would you maybe not be concerned about any of it?
I'd be more concerned about the 1487 complaint. The 1487 complaint allows the legislature to interfere with local control that goes on in the cities, and the punishment is extraordinarily severe. It takes away all state shared revenue, at least a big portion of it. And that basically, in essence, forces a city to defund the police department, which is 75% of their budget. But it's worth the fight. And so they have had a 1487 fight before. They've lost. Other cities have won. And so we'll see where it goes. But I think when it comes down to it, the council and the mayor, they're going to do what's right for their employees and their residents.
Tony, does anybody? I'm sorry, Emily, go ahead.
I was just going to add to what Tony said. The threat of a 1487 complaint is what brought Maricopa County supervisors to the table to negotiate. It's a big thing.
Yeah, related to the so-called audit there. Tony, does anybody win politically here, or is this just tit for tat?
I mean, I think that politically the mayor is going to be great in Tucson. I think that the governor isn't really playing to a base of voters anymore. He's trying to earn media from some conservative outlets. And so I think if that's a win for him, it's a win. But I think in history, people are going to be looking at people like Mayor Romero, and they're going to be thanking her for what she's done.
Emily, there's also a timing component here, right, where the 1487 complaint, there's, I think it's a 30-day window that the attorney general has to investigate, then the city has some time to respond. And if there's a dispute, it goes right to the Supreme Court, whereas if the governor, for example, were to sue, that has to go through the entire legal process, which could take a far longer time.
Absolutely. And, you know, the timing issue is key, but I think there are so many legal maneuvers that each side can make. I think we're going to see lots of lawsuits. I predict the lawsuits may last longer than the actual pandemic.
Hmm. Tony, how do you see this ultimately playing out? Like, how does this end?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, for a long time, I've thought that what the Ducey administration was doing is kind of trying to run out the clock a little bit when it comes to COVID, assuming that eventually this pandemic was going to go away. But unfortunately, as more and more people are refusing to get vaccinated, and that's actually an exaggeration, as a chunk of people, a minority of people are refusing to get vaccinated, things are lingering. And so, you know, I'm not sure how this plays out. I do think that in the end, you're going to see that the vast majority of people in the city of Tucson government will be vaccinated, and whether or not they get punished by the attorney general, we'll just have to see.
Emily, bit of an off-ramp on this one. Before the program, Mark and I were talking about what could change when 5 to 11-year-olds are able to get vaccinated. How does that change, you think, the dynamic of the fights that we're seeing? Obviously, with Tucson, we're talking about employees. But when it comes to schools and the governor's stance on that?
You know, if we start to see schools actually require kids have vaccinations, you know, that's going to open up a whole new explosive level of politicking at the school board level. And I do think we'll see the governor weigh in on that.
So, Tony, let me ask you about another disagreement that the governor is having now with the federal government about the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, basically threatening to take away the state's ability to regulate workplace safety. And this is not just related to COVID. The argument is related to COVID, but the feds are potentially looking to take all the authority away from the Industrial Commission. The governor is having some not terribly nice words for the feds and the Biden administration about this. What do you make of this potential dispute?
Not all states do enforcement. And so that's one thing I think it's important. What ends up happening is a state has, in essence, an agreement with the federal government that they will enforce the rules at least as strict as what the feds put together. And so I think that's important context here. The governor, you know, called this a political stunt. And I think what my therapist would say if I said something like that is that's projected. And, you know, this is clearly a stunt by him. You know, a year ago, I was helping nonprofit organizations in a couple of states figure out how to manage the pandemic, how to kind of reopen. And I worked with the health departments in Montana and in Colorado. And the amount of information that they gave businesses to help them stay open was so much better than what we got here. In Arizona, what they put out were two PowerPoint slides. The first PowerPoint slide was a list of things that customers had to do. And the second PowerPoint slide was just a list of recommendations. And so I think that this governor has not taken this seriously. And whether or not it's about keeping, you know, people safe. In this case, it's a dispute about healthcare workers who treat people for COVID, or whether it's about giving businesses the resources and information they need to stay open, which I think is an important part of this. If he's neglecting those responsibilities, it's the federal government's role to step in. That's the agreement and say, all right, let's do it the right way.
Emily, politically, you know, we talked about how, you know, the governor taking on Tucson is not so bad for him politically. This is not obviously the first time he's taken on the Biden administration either. Is this continuing good politics for the governor to take on the federal government?
You know, I think it is. And I think, you know, business groups will reward him for doing this. You know, Arizona has had that control over these workplace guidelines since 1985. And changing that, changing who is monitoring those things, who they're working with, has huge impacts beyond COVID, beyond healthcare, into construction and business. I guarantee you the chamber groups are very nervous about the feds coming in and taking control. And there's probably a lot of talks happening between the ninth floor and the chamber groups. And I'd also say, I find it interesting, my congressman, Congressman Stanton, has been really leading the charge from the congressional delegation in fighting back. It's almost as if he and Governor Ducey are running against each other, but we don't know what for yet.
Tony, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I think they're running against each other on whether or not to keep the people of Arizona safe. I think that's what, and healthcare workers. I think that's what it is. I used to work for Mayor Stanton, for disclosure, or when he was mayor, now congressman, you know, to sort of disclose that. But I know he's extraordinarily passionate about this. He thinks that there's been a level of neglect in Arizona when it comes to our handling of the pandemic. We have over 21,000 Arizonans who passed away because of it. And, you know, I think that it's an easy fix. I think that if I was one of the business leaders at the chamber, I might urge the governor, hey, let's do the right thing here with healthcare workers so that they can leave my other members alone. And that would end it, right? Like, just do the right thing and this goes away.
Emily, our last minute before the break, speaking of running for things, we know that Attorney General Mark Brnovich is running for the U.S. Senate nomination on the GOP side. We got a press release this morning that says he has filed an amended complaint expanding his lawsuit to stop the Biden administration, what they're calling unconstitutional and illegal COVID-19 vaccine mandates. We have seen the Attorney General step into this before. Is he doing the same thing that Tony is saying Ducey is doing, or is it something a little bit different?
Well, you know, I think that he is taking full advantage of being an incumbent running for another position and able to be in the spotlight and take a front leading role. You know, I don't want to question his motives on it, but, you know, it certainly coincides with the campaign image that he's putting forward. I just, you know, I guess I would just caution everyone that's sort of campaigning on COVID and COVID restrictions, that I think the voting electorate is getting really tired of this. I mean, obviously, we're concerned about lives lost and health. I think people are fatigued on the pandemic, and I think they're sick and tired of watching everyone argue over how to handle it. And hopefully, if the pandemic does get under control as the months pass, I think you're going to see voters really want to move on and talk about something else.
Tony, one brief thing. I want to have you comment on that before we break. I think it's maybe the type of argument. I think Emily's right that people are sort of tired of the general argument. Maybe they want to hear more specific, more cogent arguments.
Well, you know, I was the deputy for the Biden campaign here in Arizona, and so I saw a ton of polling. And one thing I saw was that people were sick of talking about COVID, but it was the thing they cared the most about. And so I think there's two different things here. They don't want the fighting. They're frustrated. But it's the lens by which people are thinking about almost all politics still as this pandemic is still raging.
Okay, that is Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Also with us is Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. With Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein. Friday Newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Democratic strategist Tony Connie and Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting.
Tony, let's talk about U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Arizona's senior senator, continues to be in the news, maybe for reasons that she would prefer not to be. We saw just a day or so ago, five veteran members of her, an advisory committee of hers, resigned. They basically called her a principal obstacle of progress. What do you make of what's going on, and how significant are these particular resignations maybe in the scope of everything that's been going on with her and legislation in Congress over the last several weeks?
I was surprised to see the resignations. When I look at the, you know, the five people who resigned, it's not, you know, this has been framed a lot as like a progressive battle versus moderates or whatever. And that's not necessarily that group of people. I think that it's a stance they feel like they had to take. But, you know, I have faith that Senator Sinema is actually, you know, negotiating with the Biden administration and try and get something done. I don't necessarily understand all the different positions that she has or, or even agree with them. But I do think that when it comes down to it, you know, this is a senator who was elected not to be bipartisan. She was elected to get things done. I think she would say that herself. Her brand is to get things done. And so, you know, the risk for her here, if I want to talk purely politics, I think, is that if it becomes, you know, more of a view that she's there to stop stuff, I think that that's going to become problematic for her. And so I think that the pressure is on, and I think that she's responding to it. And I think that we're going to see in the next couple of weeks if something gets done, and I'm hopeful that we do.
Tony, does it matter at all if it's not, in this case anyway, a progressive versus moderate kind of dispute? If 'cause that, as you say, has sort of been the narrative. Does it matter at all that that's maybe not the case here?
I think it matters a little bit because, you know, if you look at the senators who are supportive of this, you've got Klobuchar, you've got John Tester from Montana. You have some pretty, you know, conservative, moderate senators who are on board. And you know, when you look at the actual slate of policies that are being proposed and even the ways that the president has proposed to pay for them, the public really is behind them. And so I think there's going to be some – we're sitting in a community college. It seems like one of the things that may, unfortunately, in my opinion as a community college graduate, be negotiated out is the ability for, for free community college. And so there's going to be some things that are plopped out in order to get to a deal. I'm rambling a little bit here, but I think the point is that split doesn't matter when it comes to the politics of it, but I think it does matter – when you're considering who it is that's supportive of a lot of these policies.
Emily, do you have a sense we don't like to get into people's minds, but does Senator Sinema have an end game here? Do you think that there is a grand strategy here that she's trying to use?
Oh, I'm sure she has an end game. For anyone that's ever met her, she is an incredibly politically astute and brilliantly smart individual. And, you know, I just always want to remind everyone, she is behaving the way she campaigned. And, you know, I was one of the people that doubted that. I thought, no, she's going to be really extremely far left. She's just campaigning this way. And I was dead wrong. She is voting and conducting herself as someone who's trying to put Arizonans first. And she didn't do a bait and switch. She's holding true to her word. And for the far left that wants to primary her, you will see people down ticket run on primarying and how bad Kyrsten Sinema has done. And, you know, if they were to succeed in taking her out, they would lose that seat. And it's extraordinary to see that they're willing to do it. It's just an example of how selfish politics have become.
Well, Emily, it's not rare to see, obviously, infighting, whether it's Republican Party or Democratic Party. But though her ads and her strategy indicated independence, she did run as a Democrat and she got elected as a Democrat. Is there pressure that is fair to be put on her by Democrats who are saying, we have the White House, we have the Senate barely, we have the House barely, we need to get things done? And you can disagree with some of them, yes, if you want to negotiate some of them down. But what Tony said about being an obstacle, is there a danger that she's going to be seen as an obstacle as opposed to a negotiator?
You know, there could be, but I think that we're losing sight of the bigger picture, that it's far better for the Democratic Party to have her in office than to have a Republican there. And yes, of course, they can put pressure on her and try to influence and sway her to understand their point of view and make sure that she's keeping their agenda in mind. But what I'm saying is, this is an overall lack of strategy to go after her and attack her and try to take her down. They risk losing a U.S. Senate seat, which was a huge gain.
Tony, should Democrats, one thing to make noise and be concerned about where Senator Sinema is right now, regardless of how this turns out, does it make sense for Democrats to want to have a challenger, more progressive challenger potentially against her? Is that supposed to scare her, or is that supposed to actually say, hey, we want to knock you out?
I don't know what the result would be. I know that Senator Sinema has never lost a primary. She's only lost one election, and that's when she was a Green Party candidate for the state legislature. I think that there's a lot of people that are trying to find different ways to get her attention so that they can try and get these things through. I think that when it comes down to it, the bigger picture here isn't politics. The bigger picture here is what it is that the people of Arizona and the people of the United States get from their federal government. And so, you know, I know that Senator Sinema is in favor of a lot of this, and she said it. There's some disputes. You know, on the presidential campaign, she did an event that I helped put on with seniors talking about some of these issues. She campaigned for Biden to get some of this stuff done. And so there is agreement. And the sort of argument that I hear a lot from my Republican friends is they're sort of putting on her what their view is about what's going on, when really she has her own perspective. And, she does favor a lot of this stuff. And so I'm hoping that, you know, the two sides of negotiations are going to be able to come together to get something done for the people of Arizona.
Well, Tony, we heard President Biden last night during a town hall talking about the fact that he seems to have a sense of what Senator Sinema wants and what she won't go for. And does that in any way give you hope that at least they're talking and, you know, they seem to know where each other stands, and maybe that could lead to some kind of compromise here?
Yeah, I was happy to hear that last night. I think that these are two really smart people. I mean, Senator Sinema is brilliant, and the president is obviously extremely bright too. And I think that the fact that they're having conversations and they're both feeling the pressure to try and get something done, let's do it.
Emily, I'm curious about the timing on this as well, because as we know, Senator Sinema is not up for re-election for, what, 3 more years. What's going on now, will that matter in 3 years?
Probably not. And especially it won't matter if she's actually able to get something done and strike a deal. She's got lots of time to turn this into a win. And, you know, until she's a deciding vote on something that has a massive negative impact that Arizona voters understand and feel every day, a lot of this is just the continued noise out of D.C. You know, I don't think your average Arizonan is walking around mad at Kyrsten Sinema today.
Guys, for the last few minutes, let's move on to sort of a more general topic. We keep seeing, and our reporters keep reporting on it, that different legislative switches. We've got county supervisors having to decide on who's going to fill a seat for a year or so. Emily, let me just ask you generally, without getting into specific names or even Democratic or Republican parties, what is this change when a legislative session comes into play? We have a quote-unquote lame duck governor in the situation as well. How does the session look different when you have new people or people who are moving from the House to the Senate, for example?
I think it has a massive impact, because you're going to have a lot of people appointed. We've got 4 open seats right now in the House. We could have as many as 10 to 12 if people resign to focus on running for higher office. And it will have a massive impact if you've got green individuals appointed to fill out the remainder of a seat. You know, they come in and they're figuring out political relationships, where they stand on policy. And that's all happening then in an election year with tight margins and a Republican one vote lead in each chamber. It's going to make things really difficult.
And Tony, with term limits in effect, Emily used the term green. We've seen a lot of greenness down there at all. Are you concerned at all if this could affect legislation one way or the other?
Yeah, I am. It's hard to predict, because, you know, most of the appointments so far have been people who have served in the House being appointed to the Senate. And so it seems that the House is going to be the place where there's a lot of new people. The thing that I don't know about, but I'm curious about, is how this is going to impact the leadership votes of each caucus, and particularly the Republicans, and whether or not, you know, the current speaker is the speaker. And I don't have an opinion about that either way, but I think that that's probably where the most impact will come. I don't know.
Emily, I'm curious about one of the things Tony just talked about, especially in the House, where we've seen a couple of representatives move to the Senate. So clearly there are going to be a bunch of new people in the House. And that traditionally has sort of been more of the quote unquote herding cats chamber to begin with. Does it make it harder for especially Republican leadership now to have that many new people who don't know the process, where at least in the Senate you have new members who at least kind of know the process from the House?
Oh, it makes it extraordinarily difficult. And keep in mind, last session, we had a lot of new freshman members, freshmen chairing committees. And it's tough because it's a learning curve. We're now interjecting that, where maybe people would be coming into their second session. Instead, we're going to have all new people again. And it makes it really hard. And in an election year, they all want to get out early so they can campaign. And, you know, this certainly adds a challenge to that.
And that will be the last word. Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And Tony Connie, Democratic strategist. Tony, you survived. Thanks so much for being here.
I made it. Thanks.